This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
$92.53. That is today's closing price on a barrel of crude oil. Of interest to traders, of course, and drivers eventually. And ISIS right now. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday today. This one is the 25th of September. Good as always to have you with us. The latest round of airstrikes against ISIS have been more economic than anything else. The U.S. and its allies are going after the oil refineries that have helped make ISIS rich. Best guesses are they make a couple of million dollars a day from crude oil. The Pentagon has described the targets as modular refineries. Which means what exactly? And how much is knocking them out going to hurt ISIS? Marketplace's Scott Tong gets us going.
If the term modular refinery sounds sophisticated, you may want to get it out of your mind. These are glorified moonshine operations, says Middle East analyst Shwan Zulal of Carducci Consulting.
These refineries are so rudimentary, it's almost like distilling your alcohol at home. They get these big barrels and they just burn the petrol underneath it to get it distilled. You can make a new refinery in a week.
He says private citizens, i.e. a couple guys, own the refineries, not ISIS. ISIS makes money by selling crude to the refiners, and it needs the refined product, say diesel for Humvees. As for denting ISIS, the 12 refineries blown up so far may be trivial.
I think it's really 1% of the volumes that go through their hands every day.
That's Valerie Marcel of the Chatham House think tank in London.
So the U.S. and the coalition will need to bomb relentlessly.
Still, one argument for this strategy is there's little downside. Going after oil fields is more risky, says Mark Rout at KBC Technologies in Houston.
If people got concerned that, oh, we're bombing crude oil producing wells in the Middle East, the market itself might be concerned, which would raise the price of crude, which would raise the price of gasoline for everyone around the world.
Now, keep in mind, even if more refineries are flattened, ISIS, by all accounts, makes money a lot of other ways, too. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We've got a video of the setup that ISIS is using on our website. You kind of have to see it to believe it. Insane is not too harsh a word. You can check it out, marketplace.org, of course. Also, to bring together two news stories of the past 10 days or so, turns out you can buy slightly more refined modular refineries on Alibaba. Prices start at $1,000. Just because hackers and lost credit card data and privacy breaches aren't enough, there was a new and different warning today. The cybersecurity team at the Department of Homeland Security says there is a new computer bug out there that could be really, really bad. It's called shell shock. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. He is here to make me smart. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Kai.
All right, this sounds terrible. Shell shock. What is it exactly?
Okay, so shell shock is a new security hole, and this is a way for hackers to get access to our information that we don't want to give up. And it is connected to a couple of operating systems called Unix and Linux. Now, these are very basic ways in which computers work and organize information, and they're used for everything from Facebook to your Apple computer, for instance, uses some of the tools based in this software.
Is it like deep down in the operating system, or is it something that I can figure out by myself?
Oh, no, 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 no. I wouldn't go in. I wouldn't go down into the okay. basement and mess around with this stuff. This is pretty complex stuff, and it's pretty fundamental to the operating systems we're talking about here. And so security folks are trying to build the fix for this.
If it happens to infect my computer, what happens then? What are the consequences?
Well, have you ever seen a zombie movie?
No, I don't do scary stuff, but, you know, that's a whole different thing.
Well, think of a hacker actually taking full control of your computer or a piece of software or website and basically doing what they will with it. That could mean taking your privileged data. That could mean using your computer as part of a botnet of zombie computers that infect other computers with malware and viruses and things like that. So it's pretty bad.
This thing is being compared to Heartbleed, which I think you and I talked about a couple of months ago. And that was pretty bad, right?
Yeah. First we had Heartbleed, and now we're shell-shocked about it. Yes.
That's right.
It was pretty bad, and it was deemed to be a huge cost to businesses in the millions of dollars, maybe even more. They're still sort of tallying the cost and the price tag of that. Now, the difference here is that Heartbleed just gave access to a user's data. Shellshock can give total control over to hackers, and this is the problem.
Yeah. What do I do? Do I wait for the IT guys here at Marketplace to download a patch? Do I do extra stuff on my computer at home? Am I helpless? What?
Just be nice to the IT guys. You know what I mean?
I'm always nice to the IT guys.
If they look at yeah, you better be.
I'm no dope, man. You kidding me?
Well, as a user, unfortunately, as an end user, there's not much you can do here except wait for the people who know what they're doing to build the patches and fix these things on the back end. And in the meantime, I think you be extra careful, as I know you always are, about clicking on links that come from mysterious people in your email and things like that, and just kind of ride it out and hope for the best, man.
Good computer hygiene. Ben Johnson, the host of Marketplace Tech. Thank you, Ben.
You got it, Kai.
Attorney General Eric Holder announced his resignation this afternoon. Holder has been in office as long as the president has, as you know, since just after the worst of the financial crisis. This, by the way, is the complete list of Wall Street CEOs prosecuted by the Holder Justice Department for their roles in that crisis. Traders, I would bet, would have preferred crickets today to the very, very sad music they got. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Except for a couple of out-of-the-way places in Alaska, flying drones for commercial use has been largely illegal in this country. Doesn't mean they're not flying, as you know. They are used in everything from real estate to agriculture, and as of today, legally, in movie making. The FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, says it's going to let studios use drones on set. Marketplace's Queenie Kim reports.
The U.S. has led the world in developing the technology behind drones, but it's fallen behind when it comes to letting them fly legally. Phil Finnegan is an aviation analyst with the Teal Group, and he says regulators in other countries are already allowing drones to film movies and TV.
Countries like Canada, Australia, United Kingdom, a lot of European countries that are going after this market.
Finnegan says it'll take the FAA several years to finalize regulations for all drones, but he believes this initial move will make the American motion picture industry more competitive on the world stage. The FAA announced 6 permits today. Ziv Marone is with ZM Interactive, which used drones to provide aerial shots in the action film The Expendables 3. Marone applauds the FAA's decision, but he says the process is moving slowly, and so don't expect to see a critical mass of movie drones anytime soon.
It will take some time before people will actually get the permits.
Marone says that drone pilots will have to follow strict regulations. That is, make sure pilots have proper training, safe equipment, and a myriad of other rules. But how will this affect the helicopter and airplane industry that has cornered this market so far? Keith Harder is the owner of Star Helicopters, and he's not worried that drones will cut into his business.
There's room for both types of businesses.
And if it turns out he's wrong, he says most helicopter companies have diversified their businesses enough that they don't rely on shooting movies to make money. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
Richard Branson, the billionaire founder of the Virgin Group, can take as many days off as he likes. Money can do that for you. Now, though, Branson has extended that privilege to a number of his employees. As much vacation as they want, no need to ask permission, and nobody's going to keep tabs. The caveat, and you knew there would be at least one, is that, and this is a quote, their absence will not in any way damage the business or, for that matter, their careers. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explores what happens when vacation time is left up to the workers.
I have a dream that includes a month of paid vacation by the sea in August and another couple of weeks in the winter. This is not my reality. But Scott Francis says an unlimited vacation policy wasn't the dream he thought it would be.
It sounded really cool to me until I started working at a company that had one.
He was working at a tech startup at the time.
The two problems that I had were not feeling like I had necessarily earned vacation because it wasn't accruing, and also feeling like it was going to reflect negatively on me if I took vacation that wasn't owed to me.
Now he's got a couple of weeks and likes that better. In fact, he's off today and going to the beach with his kids.
It's sometimes easier to accept something that is given to you, even if you don't like it, than to be the one to decide how to extend this time off from work.
Susan Krause-Whitborn is a psychology professor at UMass Amherst. She says Americans feel they'll look lazy if they take too much vacation. On the plus side, unlimited vacation can shift priorities from time spent at work to the amount of work accomplished, says Lottie Balin. She's an emeritus professor at MIT Sloan School of Management. But in practice,
without any guidelines, people are going to be quite nervous. And we know in some companies, actually, people have not been taking very much.
She says higher-ups can lead by example and say, check you later, I'm going to Hawaii for 2 weeks. Live in the dream. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
The free market-oriented public policy group ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, is losing some high-profile members. In the past couple of days, Yahoo, Yelp, Facebook, and Google have all said they have left or will leave ALEC over policy disagreements. That is not to say, though, that tech companies aren't interested in public policy or in lobbying to influence it. Silicon Valley used to steer well clear of Congress. Now it's one of the biggest spenders on Capitol Hill. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has more.
Tech companies wanted to ignore Washington, but Washington wasn't about to ignore them. A few years ago, Congress debated some big bills on internet policy, and Silicon Valley wasn't at the table. So tech companies opened D.C. headquarters. And 2 years ago, web giants like Google, Amazon, and Facebook joined forces to create a new trade group, the Internet Association.
Our digital team, communications.
Michael Beckerman is the association's president and CEO. He shows me around their sleek new Washington office and explains why he's here.
And that's my job, is to help build relationships and bridge the gap between our industry and Congress.
That gap makes it hard for tech to gain traction in Washington. Part of the problem, it takes time to build relationships on Capitol Hill, and tech is new to the K Street lobby game. Also, the tech industry wants quick movement on huge issues like immigration and patent reform. Beckerman says back in Silicon Valley, they can't understand what's taking so long.
In the internet world and in Silicon Valley, people see a problem and they find a way to solve it. But that's not always how Washington works.
No, it's not. So Beckerman and his chief lobbyist, Gina Woodworth, make regular trips to Capitol Hill. Today they're off to Congressman Paul Ryan's office. Of course, we take an Uber SUV. Woodworth says she'll be talking trade.
The last time they drafted a trade bill was in 2002. In 2002, a lot of our companies weren't even created, and we weren't really an active stakeholder at that time. But now we are.
And they have the cash to prove it. Sheila Krumholtz heads the Center for Responsive Politics, which tracks lobbyist spending in Washington.
Spending by the tech sector has more than tripled since 1998.
Krumholtz says the tech lobby budget went from $40 million in the late 90s to more than $140 million last year. And she says Silicon Valley is on track to spend at least that much this year. Today, tech is the fourth biggest spender on lobbying in Washington. But
what they get for all this lobbying is not clear.
Anthony Corrado teaches government at Colby College.
Even on a very narrow issue like immigration reform and a modification of visa policy to allow more engineers in, for example, they can't get any action.
What's worse, Corrado says, sometimes tech companies lobby on different sides of an issue, like net neutrality, which pits the companies that built the pipes of the internet against the users of those pipes. Corrado says there's a clear winner here, and it's not the tech lobby.
Members of Congress are more than happy to have tech industry lobbying on both sides of an issue because it makes it much easier for them to solicit campaign contributions.
Corrado calls it a fundraising bonanza. Welcome to Washington, Silicon Valley. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we're working with physical world retailers right now to make their store windows touch screens. So at night when the store is closed, people can come by and actually use the store window to shop.
Cool, right? eBay's got big plans, but first, let's do the numbers. You knew it'd be the wah-wah trombones, right? Come on, you knew it. The Dow Industrial's off 264 points today, 1.5%, ended at 16,945. The NASDAQ off 88 points, just shy of 2%, 44.66. The S&P 500 shed 32 points, 1.6%, closed at 1966. The market swoon, in part, is what happens when the country's biggest company, market value-wise, makes a relative handful of consumer products, gadgets, you could almost say. That would be Apple, of course, and a lot of those products, including millions of just-purchased iPhones, didn't work so great after Apple updated its operating system this week. Uh-oh. Apple shares off 3.8%, erasing more stock value than most corporations are worth in their entirety. Companies like, Ford, Toyota maybe as well. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note off to 2.50%. 2.5% is another way to say that. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department issues its final estimate for second quarter gross domestic product. It's famous for its keyboard. BlackBerry announces quarterly earnings. And on September 26, 1957, the musical West Side Story opened on Broadway. It ran for 732 performances. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. New standards for California olive oil go into effect this week. Growers here want to increase their tiny share of the global market. Right now, less than 1% of all the olive oil produced in the world is California grown. Most of what we buy in this country comes from the Mediterranean. But California is famously blessed with that Mediterranean climate. So why isn't it an olive oil powerhouse like Spain or Italy? Sarah Gardner drove a few hours southeast of Los Angeles in search of answers.
In a small shop in the town of Temecula, Trudy Batty is working the tasting room.
So I'll pour a little bit of the lime. You just take it to your nose, smell it, and then just take a little sip. That's all you have to do.
Barring that reference to lime, you'd be forgiven for thinking this was a wine tasting. But customers here are sipping olive oils. Yes, there's a buttery extra virgin, but there are also olive oils blended with rosemary, with garlic, with, God help us, jalapenos. Batty's talking up the lime.
So I personally like this for fajitas. It's beautiful for shrimp, corn on the cob.
Purists nice may scoff, but that doesn't bother Tom Curry. He's general manager of Temecula Olive Oil, the company that makes these products. With his long hair, floppy fedora, and a faded T-shirt that reads, "Reduce your dependence on foreign oil," Curry exudes laid-back Southern California.
We'll just take a little walk into the grove down here.
Curry says California's olive oil is as good as Europe's, certainly higher quality than much of the cheap imported stuff at the supermarket. Some of that is labeled extra virgin when it's not, he says. American growers have complained to trade authorities about labeling fraud and generous European subsidies, but low-cost imports aren't the only problem.
I think we're going to be limited for at least the near future by the amount of acres planted. Once we get to tens and hundreds of thousands of acres, that's when we can start really taking over the world.
More like 500,000 just to meet domestic demand alone. Still, when talking to Curry, it's hard not to think of that indie movie Bottle Shock, the story about those pioneering California winemakers 40 years ago.
These Californian wines are all so good.
What were you expecting, Thunderbird?
Just like Napa's neophyte vintners in the 70s, California olive oil makers are trying to convince Americans to seek out domestic brands, even if some of them cost more than they're used to paying. Many growers here are planting trees close together so they can harvest mechanically and cut costs. They're also experimenting in new terrain. Curry's company is expanding into the desert just north of Mexico.
We're planting in some of the worst areas of the Imperial Valley to see if the olive trees can grow there. And if they can grow there, they can grow pretty much anywhere.
Good thing, too, because if California's drought continues, olives may be one of the few crops to thrive. They don't need much water compared to, say, almonds, another specialty crop here. The Spanish missionaries discovered that early on when they established the olive trade in this country. But there was little incentive to make it big business. Olive oil was always a niche market in the United States, says Erin Balch. She's with the North American Olive Oil Association.
Consider that, you know, 40 years ago, olive oil, you know, it was sold like in pharmacies in the United States. It was a special little health product. Or, you know, in the northeast part of the country, Italian food and those kind of things started bringing olive oil into cooking here.
But something changed. Healthier eating, the Mediterranean diet, whatever. Americans now consume three times the olive oil they did 20 years ago. And California growers are determined to at least triple their share of that market. This week, the state adopted testing and labeling rules for California-made olive oil, a move supporters hope will signal high quality to consumers. The European Union calls the new standards burdensome and confusing. In Temecula, California, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
There are, at any given time, something like 700 million items for sale on eBay. It helped introduce the world to online shopping almost 20 years ago, and commerce writ large really hasn't been the same since. eBay owns PayPal and StubHub. It's got a stake in Craigslist as well. But as retail changes, so too does eBay.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
Today on Conversations from the Corner Office, eBay CEO John Donahoe. John, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here.
I bet if you went out on the street today and asked, 10 people what eBay does, they would say, probably nine of them would say, oh, yeah, it does online auctions and stuff. My guess is you would prefer the company not be characterized that way anymore.
Well, what we've always done, Kai, is connecting buyers and sellers globally. And initially that was done in an auction format, but really consumers have changed their preferences over time. So we just give consumers choice, and today that's about 70% fixed price and 30% auctions.
Don't you find it kind of remarkable that, you know, online shopping is only like 6% or something of all retail in this country, and we spend so much time talking about it?
The way we think about it is, in over half of all retail transactions in the United States last year, the consumer accessed the web at some point in their shopping experience. The lines between what used to be called e-commerce and retail are blurring.
Okay, so here comes the heresy to a guy who works in online shopping. But should we just get rid of the phrase online shopping and just call it shopping?
Yeah, absolutely. We talk about our core purpose as being connected commerce, technology connected. And then an important part of eBay's core mission and purpose is to make it a more personal experience, so that you aren't buying from some unknown, sterile retailer or person you don't know. You're buying from often a human being, a small business person, or inside a store. When we used to shop on Main Street, many of the shop owners knew your name. That's changed over the last 30, 40 years. You walk down the Main Street, and most of the stores you go into, the sales associates don't really know who you are. Technology can change that. It can change that online, and it can change that in the physical world, where you can get personalized experience.
Talk to me about the online shopping experience in, 5 years. What's it going to look like? Because if you look at eBay 5 years ago, it's a different company, right?
Well, I think we're still in the early days of the power of mobile device. And in 5 years, the word mobile may mean a different thing. So, for instance, we're working with physical world retailers right now to build, to make their store windows touchscreens. So at night when the store is closed, people can come by and actually use the store window to shop.
Wow.
We're working with retailers where the mirrors in the dressing rooms become, in essence, touchscreens. You can use virtual reality to try different combinations, different colors, even if that color's not in stock. You can buy it right there from the dressing room. So you're going to have connected screens and connected devices, not just in your hand with your smartphone or at home with your tablet or your laptop, but they're going to be all over.
Last thing, sir, and then I'll let you go. And I asked your predecessor, Meg Whitman, this, not when she was at eBay, but now that she's at HP. I asked Tim Armstrong at AOL. I asked the president, and here's the question. What does your company do in five words or less?
Connect buyers and sellers globally.
They told you this question was coming, right?
No, I just made it up.
All right. Well, good.
I don't know how many words that was.
No, that was five. Connect buyers and sellers globally.
Four or five.
John Donahoe, CEO of eBay. Mr. Donahoe, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
You can find all of our corner office interviews, plus lots more, using our Marketplace app. You can download it at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, in which we learn once again that when you are writing the paychecks, you get to make the rules. Steve Ballmer, the former CEO of Microsoft, is, as you know, the new owner of the Los Angeles Clippers. Spent $2 billion to buy him, Mr. Ballmer did. Now, though, he is nickel and diming. In an interview with Reuters published today, Ballmer said the Clippers are going to have to be getting rid of all of their iPads. Yep, $2 billion. All right, we're done. That is the show for today. The Dow off 264 points, 1.5%. The NASDAQ down 88 points. That is just shy of 2%. The S&P 500 lost 32 points, 1.6%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Kim Bowie, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.